Welcome to Brain Observations, the podcast where we're curious about how the brain and mind works and how you can use this knowledge to improve your experience of life. I set out to find and talk to some of the most knowledgeable people out there, and at the end of each episode, I sum up what we have learned from today's guest. Me, I'm Maria Sundell, I'm a clinical neurologist, and with this podcast, I hope to make scientific evidence on well-being and brain health more easily available. And my wish is to inspire you to learn more and find ways to improve your own life. I also want to mention that even though I am a medical doctor, this is a personal project and not affiliated with my hospital. The information in this podcast is meant to educate and inspire and should not be taken as medical advice. I advise you to discuss any potential changes to your lifestyle with your own personal doctor. And this is even more important if you are experiencing trouble with your mental health. Today's guest, Dr. Claudia Trudel Fitzgerald, has her background in clinical and health psychology. She completed a postdoctoral fellowship in social epidemiology at Harvard and was then a research scientist at the Lee Kum Shung Center for Health and Happiness at Harvard until the summer of 2021. She recently moved to Montreal, Canada, where she holds positions at the Université du Québec à Trois-Rivières and Institut Universitaire en Santé Mentale de Montréal. As a researcher, she's looking at the interplay between psychosocial factors and physical health, and she has also developed an expertise in the measurement of psychological well-being. Her work seeks to find out what makes people adopt healthy lifestyle habits, age in health, and live longer. She's also interested in how we can increase this through public health measures and how the science of well-being can help us understand and reduce health disparities due to social inequalities. Hello and welcome to this podcast. How are you doing today? We're so happy to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure. I'm good. What about you?
Well, the darkness is starting to get to me. It's that feeling where it gets really dark in the afternoon, and I guess you can relate to that.
Yeah, we have the same situation in Montreal, Canada.
Just waiting for more snow.
Exactly.
It gets so much better. So today we're going to talk about psychological well-being and how important that is to enter into the general debate of health and the public health system. And this is something that you've been doing research on for quite some time.
Yes, absolutely.
Could you tell me a bit about what spurred your interest in this topic of research?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a clinical psychologist by training. So for many years now, I've been thinking about, you know, depression, anxiety, things that are more challenging for individuals. And during my graduate studies, I wanted to learn a little bit more about different things. And I was working a lot with cancer patients back then, clinically and also in research. And I did an internship, a research internship during my grad school. I was in Quebec City. And I went to Harvard School of Public Health doing research in social epidemiology and looking at to what extent different psychological factors could impact the risk of developing cardiovascular disease, which was the expertise of my mentor back then. That was many years ago, a decade ago, actually. And she started doing work on psychological well-being increasingly. So being under, you know, our guidance and mentoring, I started exploring that field as well. And, you know, I entered the field, you know, well-being, it's probably the absence of psychological distress. So if you're not like depressed or anxious, you're probably happy, kind of a little naive perspective, which a lot of people have actually, but what we're understanding with the field of well-being increasingly is that it's more than the absence of distress. So when I started working on this a decade ago, quickly I realized that, you know, you could not be anxious or not be depressed, but it doesn't mean that you have a strong sense of purpose in life, that you're satisfied with your life, that you're optimistic or that kind of thing. So that was my first studies and exploration in this field. And as I mentioned, it's been a decade ago and really a rewarding journey learning about what is psychological well-being, what are the different dimensions, how we measure it, and how it relates to physical health over time.
I can imagine. And do you think we're becoming more and more aware of the importance of psychological well-being for our health?
Absolutely. So it's been a flourishing field over the past decade or so. People increasingly acknowledge that it's more than the absence of distress. So just to give you an example, someone could be living with an anxiety disorder, but at the same time have a really strong sense of purpose in life and be really driven to do things. So people, both like the general population, but clinicians, researchers, increasingly acknowledge that psychological well-being on its own independently of psychological distress is really important. And obviously, we know that it's important for mental health, but increasingly, we're acknowledging that it might be important for physical health as well. So increasingly, data showing that it could relate to different physical health outcomes. So another reason to bother about psychological well-being.
And so when you're doing research on this topic, how do you define psychological well-being for the purpose of research?
Yes, for the purpose of research, it's interesting because when you survey researchers and when you survey the lay population, people will say roughly the same things about what is psychological well-being. Upfront, everybody acknowledged that it's more than happiness. You know, sometimes when you say well-being upfront, people will think about happiness. But actually, it's good to think about psychological well-being as an umbrella term. So there are really different dimensions that falls under the label of psychological well-being, if you want. There are different definitions, different conceptualization, but still there are theoretical dimensions that people will refer to often. One of it is eudaimonic well-being. So we're talking about like purpose in life, personal growth, mastery on your own life. So that's one dimension. There is the other one that is hedonic well-being. So we're talking about state well-being, positive affect, to what extent are you happy, joyful, cheerful, these kinds of things. And then there are all the other dimensions that don't necessarily fall under the eudaimonic or hedonic well-being. And these include, for instance, optimism, which is an important facet of psychological well-being as well. So these are the different ways typically around the world we'll be thinking about psychological well-being and different facets that we've been studying either as an outcome, so how people do in general, or as a predictor of different other outcomes as well. What's really interesting is that there are other facets of psychological well-being that are culturally dependent. And I'll give you the example of ikigai. Have you heard about this before?
Yeah, it's a Japanese term, right?
Yeah, exactly. So ikigai is really specific to the Japanese population. And when we ask Japanese individuals who speaks English, how does that translate in English? Oftentimes they will say there's no exact word that captures ikigai in English. So it's really unique. It's pretty close to purpose in life, but there's also some aspect in ikigai, a little bit of like positive affect that is kind of blended in there. So that's really unique to this population. And it's been increasingly studied as well as another facets of well-being.
Do you think that can be then sort of translated culturally? Because I know books on ikigai have become more and more popular among Western cultures as well. And we read on it and we do this little chart. To what extent do you think the cultural aspect is important when it comes to these different ways of thinking?
I think it remains important because we will understand ikigai maybe slightly differently than the Japanese population will do. But as I mentioned, it's pretty close to purpose in life. It's not only that, but we can fairly easily relate to purpose in life. So I suspect this is why when we read books on ikigai, we can connect with that construct because there is something similar for us, but it might be a little bit different than how it is understood for the Japanese population.
Yeah, everybody kind of translates it into their own life and what it means to them. So when doing this research on psychological well-being, what have you found when it comes to the connection to physical health?
So we've been thinking a lot about psychological well-being as a predictor or a protective factor, if you want, for physical health in the long term. And interestingly, earlier, we really embraced what we call a deficit focus perspective, which means that we were interested in the extent to which psychological well-being could predict the risk of developing chronic disease over time. So a lot of the work in public health and health psychology, we're really interested in what's shaping the risk of developing cancer, heart disease, longevity or mortality, etc. So some of the first studies, we were really interested in different facets of psychological well-being. So optimism, happiness, life satisfaction, purpose in life. And most of them were showing a protective effect, so lower risk of dying over the course of follow-up in our studies, lower risk of developing different conditions that are cardiovascular. However, with cancer, I have to say the results are less clear. And one of the reasons that might be, I think there are several reasons, but one of the reasons is that cancer is actually not one disease per se, but it's different disease, as you know, the subtype of cancer. And in studies, oftentimes because we don't have that much people participating in the study, we need to combine those cancer sites together. So we're kind of having what we call noise in there. And that might be one of the reasons we don't see association. And maybe there is no association either between well-being and cancer. So that's been like earlier work, and we're still doing this kind of work, really thinking about the risk of chronic disease or mortality. But over the past few years, there's been this switch in how we think about health. So you remember earlier I told you we were thinking psychological distress is the only thing, and now we're acknowledging that psychological well-being is important as well. So in the field of health, it's been kind of the same process. So we've been thinking a lot about disease and what's detrimental for health, but we're increasingly thinking about how we can promote healthy aging, how we can make people live longer and live healthier. So our more recent work has been looking at this. So how different facets of psychological well-being could relate or could promote healthy aging. We had a study looking at exceptional longevity. So people who live beyond 85 years old, are they more optimistic, for instance? So that has been kind of a newer way we've been thinking about the association between psychological well-being and health.
And do you think these older subjects that go beyond 85, do you think they are older because they have the optimism, or do you think they develop the optimism over time?
That's a really good question. So optimism, oftentimes we will think about this as a trait, kind of a personality trait. It's fairly stable over time. Of course, you can intervene upon it, you can modify it, but upfront without any intervention, it's fairly stable over the life course. So we would suspect that these people have been optimistic for a while. And this, combined with other different factors, you know, like the genetic, of course, chronic conditions and everything, would lead to living longer.
And so the studies that are made often look at distinct parts of psychological well-being and their relation to mortality, such as positive effect, for example. That is one of them, the hedonic part of well-being, how happy we are, how much pleasure we seek. Do we still see a connection with all of these subparts, or is it when we connect all of those together that we have an effect?
Yeah, this is a really good question, and this is what we try to get to with our review that I think you read on psychological being as being part of the public health debate. We did this kind of review of the literature looking at all these different facets of well-being and the extent to which they could be associated with mortality risk over time, to try to see, are there some that are more important, associated more strongly with mortality? And you can think about this in terms of intervention. That's really important, right? Because if we find that some facets of psychological well-being are more strongly associated, then maybe you want to intervene on these first rather than those that are less strongly associated or not associated, maybe. And in the case of positive affect, it's a peculiar one. Some of the first studies that was conducted on this topic was the Nunn study. Have you heard about the Nunn study?
I don't think so.
Okay, so that was, I don't remember the year exactly, but the researcher looked at biographies of nuns. So it was written text, and they kind of derived a code of positive affect. So they were able to see across the different nuns from their autobiography to what extent they have a higher level of positive affect or a lower positive affect level. And then they tested the relationship with mortality over time, and they found that nuns who had a greater score, if you want, of positive affect would live longer. So you can understand that was like something that everybody heard about. It was discussed quite a bit back then. So that was one of the earlier study. And then there've been a couple of other studies looking at positive affect as a broad category. So it means that it will look at happiness, but also if people are joyful, cheerful, energetic, enthusiastic. So there are different little facets of positive affect. Typically, what we see is that it's associated with lower risk of mortality over time. That being said, there are a couple of studies where they look at happiness specifically, and there are a few studies when they do that, they don't see the association with mortality over time. So there could be a couple of reasons. Maybe it's the general positive affect. So all these different emotional states that I mentioned are important together. But when we're looking at happiness per se or only, that's not a strong predictor of mortality over time. So that could be one reason. The other reason is that many of these studies on happiness, they use a single item. So now I'm getting into more like the methodsy details about these studies. But when you use a single item, maybe it's not capturing the construct comprehensively enough, and we're missing some part of it. And that also could explain why there were no association in some studies as well.
Do we know anything about the fluctuations of well-being, how the ups and downs affect us?
Yes, that's a good point you bring up, because these facets of well-being, some are more considered as traits, like optimism, but others are more like states. So we expect that happiness or being joyful could change a little bit more over time. And to be able to do these studies, we need data that was collected at several time points and that they ask these dimensions of psychological well-being repeatedly, so we're able to look at change over time. We increasingly see that kind of study, but I'll say it's a flourishing field as well. There are more and more studies, but it's more recent. And so far, what we see is that people who have sustained high level of well-being have lower risk of mortality of chronic disease over time. People who have a sustained lower risk of well-being, they are at greater risk typically of early mortality and chronic disease. And people who are fluctuating, so either their well-being over time will decrease or it will increase over time, the results are more mixed for that. And I think it's a question of getting more studies to see if there are some trends that we can see from these research. But it's an evolving field in that sense. A couple of other studies are showing that variation more closely could be associated with higher risk of mortality. So if in general you don't have a high level of psychological well-being, and within that low level, you do vary quite a bit. So some days you're really happy, some days you're really unhappy. It seems that that could not be optimal for physical health and longevity over time.
And maybe that could have something to do then with the swinging in between sort of happy and unhappy would make the unhappiness more intense in a way, or become more stressful because then we're missing that happy part when we don't have it.
Yeah, and you could suspect also that for the body, it takes a lot of resources to go in this back and forth between a higher level and lower level. So that could be one way psychological well-being get kind of under the skin and impact longer health.
Yeah. And so what are the different theories around the cause and effect, the connection between psychological well-being and mortality? Why is it good for us?
There are a couple of what we call pathways or mechanisms, and these are good for mortality risk, but they are good also for a lot of chronic health disease, especially chronic cardiovascular diseases. One way is the behavioral one. So all the health behaviors or lifestyle that could explain why psychological well-being is associated with future health outcomes. And we can think about those in terms of the habits that are detrimental. So people who have a higher level of psychological well-being may be less likely to smoke, or they may be less likely to have an important consumption of alcohol. And in turn, they have a better health, or they are less likely to develop chronic disease over time. It could also promote more favorable health behaviors. So people with a higher level of psychological well-being may be more likely to have a healthy diet, engage in more physical activity. And as we know, this is really important for physical health in the long term. So these are all kind of the health behaviors. There is also research by our group showing that people who have, for instance, higher purpose in life are more likely to follow the medical recommendation and, you know, go to your annual screening or that kind of things. And we know that this could also promote better health over time. So that's kind of the behavioral pathway. And then there is everything that relates to the biology. So as I was saying earlier, how psychological well-being gets under the skin. And in this pathway, results have been a little bit less clear. So we've seen data showing that higher level of life satisfaction or other facets of psychological well-being could be associated with higher level of antioxidant, for instance, or healthier lipid profiles. So that could be important risk factor for long-term health. But we've been conducting other studies looking at, for instance, telomere length or epigenetic age, and we don't see association, for instance, with optimism. So it seems like there could be different biological processes that impact long-term health outcomes, but they are not all associated with psychological well-being. And this field has been moving quite a bit. So there are other biomarkers that we could explore. Notably, I'm sure you heard about the gut microbiome. So that's another thing that researchers are really excited about and could be one of the pathway or one of the mechanism that would relate our levels of psychological well-being in relation to physical health.
I would imagine that the fact that psychological well-being is so strongly individual, everybody has their own brain that has been shaped completely separate from everybody else's throughout life, makes it difficult. There are so many different things that interconnect into shaping how we feel about things and what happiness is to us and how we perceive stress and how much anxiety we have, that, I mean, that is the part also that makes it really fascinating. But it makes me think that the interventions need to be kind of individualized quite a lot.
Yes, it could be. And at the same time, it's interesting to think about intervention that could be brought up at the population level to have a stronger impact, right? So there is a question of finding which dimension of psychological well-being is more important. There is also this question, I would say, whether all dimensions are equal, but if you intervene on more than one, do you see some kind of duplicative impact on health? Or if you can just intervene on one and that's enough. So these are like really interesting open question in the field. But I really like what you brought up in terms of how it can impact how we cope with stress. And that's actually another way psychological well-being could be beneficial for health. I mentioned the behavioral pathway, the biological pathway, but the other way we think about it is that not only psychological well-being could be a direct risk factor or determinant of health, but we think also that psychological well-being could buffer the effect of stress on health. So there is a lot of research showing that anxiety, depression, being exposed to different stressors in life could, to a certain extent, impact physical health outcomes. And we think that psychological well-being could be what we call a buffer of this effect of stress, or in other words, psychological well-being could undo the effect of stress on health. And I think this idea is also interesting from the intervention point of view that you brought up, because stress is part of our life. You know, we'll continue to be faced with stressor. Feeling anxious or sad is our normal emotional reaction of the human experience. So we don't need to like completely remove them. We need to experience them. But if we have greater level of psychological well-being, that could be a way to buffer or to attenuate the effect of stress-related factors on future health outcomes. And I think in terms of intervention, this is how we start thinking more and more about how we can promote these facets of psychological well-being in different population to attenuate the effect of stress.
Well, I think that's a really important point to talk about, because in today's, at least our society, we tend to think a lot about avoidance, that we want to avoid things that are stressful, we want to avoid things that are painful, and a little bit, as you alluded to before, that we think that psychological well-being is just the absence of psychological distress. So we just want to remove the things that are making us feel bad. But maybe it's more about kind of accepting, as you said, the human experience and look more into resilience, look more into acceptance and how to regulate and live with those emotions that we're inevitably going to have. And that is something that is entering the debate or the discussion more and more today.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And just looping back on the studies I've been talking about with physical health, every time, and that's again a really methodsy detail, but every time we look at these associations, we will adjust in our statistical model, we'll control for the level of psychological distress. So we're acknowledging that people can experience anxiety, can experience depression. And we see most of the time that even if we take that into account, the psychological distress experience of the participants, we see association of well-being over and above. So it seems like there is something that is there independently of the level of distress. So we're kind of saying, you know, even if you're experiencing distress, well-being could be good for you as well. And I really like the fact that you brought up this idea of like coping or regulating. This is something that we see, among other things, in people who are more optimistic. We think that optimistic individuals have a good impact or can see better health outcomes over time, notably because of the good behaviors, the biological processes. But another reason is that typically they're fairly good in problem solving, you know? So when they face a stressor, it's a stressor for them as well as for everybody. But then they will say, okay, well, this is happening, but I think it will turn fine. So what can I do to face this problem? What are the different steps I can engage in to face the difficult situation? And then that could contribute to better mental health and better physical health over time.
I think the thing that you talked about, that you can see that even though you have anxiety or depression, psychological well-being is still something that can affect your quality of life and also your physical health, is a very hopeful message, because a lot of people struggle with depression and anxiety that is difficult to treat. And if we kind of see the health effects only in a manner where we connect it to psychological distress, it can feel for these people as if, well, things are never going to be okay for me. I'm always going to be suffering and it's going to be bad for my health. But to then say that, okay, we're going to work on the anxiety, we're going to work on the depression to the extent that we can manage it. But if we work on these other aspects of psychological well-being, there are still important things that you can gain from that. And it's not completely useless. Just because you still have some anxiety and depression doesn't mean that we shouldn't see this as important.
Absolutely. And this is such an important take-home message that you're doing there. And I hope everybody will appreciate that listening to the podcast. There are things that can be done. Psychological well-being can help regardless of how we're dealing with anxiety, depression. And I think a related idea to this point is that all this field of research is not done to put some guilt on individuals. So we're not trying to say, you know, you're not happy enough, or you're not don't have a strong purpose in life, or that kind of thing, and it's going to be bad for your mental and physical health. The goal is rather to say, okay, we know we age, we know we are likely to develop chronic disease over time. What can we do in terms of modifiable factors? Age cannot be changed that much. Our genetic cannot be aged that much to this point. But there are factors on which we have more control. So let's try to identify those factors so we can intervene upon them. So that's really the goal, rather than putting some pressure on people or trying to make them feel guilty. That's really not the goal. And relatedly, the idea is to look at the individual level, but really trying to think further and further how we can expand these results to the environment. And that's really important, because we don't want to put the pressure at the individual level. It's good that we think about psychological well-being, to know different strategies about how we can increase it. But the big $1 million question is how we can promote psychological well-being from the environment. So what are the structural changes we can do? And that's really the public health perspective that we need to bring to really promote this among a different subgroup of the population.
And what are some ideas in that area on what is possible to do? Is there research being done? Are there interventions being tested?
So they are. In positive psychology, there is a lot of intervention studies where they looked at what we call self-administered exercises. And that's one of the beauty, I think, of positive psychology, is that a lot of these little interventions are things that people can do on their own. So one of them is the best possible self, which has been shown by the data as being one of the best exercises to increase your optimism level. So you'll have to picture yourself in 5 years or 10 years and reflect on what would be the ideal person that I would be, either generally, or that could be in terms of physical health. So what would be my ideal physical health at that point? And then start to think about what would be the obstacles to reach that person later on, and then how I can put some different steps to help me reach that goal. And then by doing this kind of reflection exercise, people in studies have shown that after doing it a couple of times, or at least like really intensively for one time, they report higher level of optimism. So that's one way to increase optimism. And there are other exercises that people can do on their own. So that's, again, more at the individual level. But then at the environmental level, these are bigger changes. It takes more time, but we're doing the science of well-being to really provide data to support these more structural changes. That could be various things. For example, we could start having psychological well-being classes in school. And that would be so important, because we know that these elements of psychological functioning are shaped earlier in life. And if you want them to be important and support you throughout your life for your mental, but also your physical health, going earlier might be a good idea. So, you know, people have thought of different courses that kids can have in school. Why not having one that talks about psychological well-being and presents some strategies to increase psychological well-being, better cope with stressors? So really promoting a favorable, positive mental health. So that could be one way. Another example I like to give is supporting, in terms of insurance refund, psychotherapy. So that's another way people could increase psychological well-being, is by seeing a psychotherapist, could be a psychologist, social worker, psychiatric, but seeking help to not only decrease any depression or anxiety symptoms, but also start more and more thinking of how I can increase my purpose in life, my satisfaction with life, my optimism lens. And if we could cover partly or fully these services, that would be ideal in promoting psychological well-being.
Because the goal is to make this accessible to everyone, regardless of socioeconomic status. Because I think today a lot of it is connected to privilege. The more privilege you have, the easier it becomes, because you have less of stress around you, you have more supportive network, you don't have to worry about so much maybe your health or your housing situation and things like this. And since psychological or psychotherapeutic help is often not covered by insurance or part of the public healthcare system, it is something that people with money can use to improve their health. So the long-term goal must, of course, be to find ways to make this accessible to, first and foremost, the people that are most in need, and make it accessible to everyone.
Absolutely, absolutely. This is a really important point. And oftentimes I hear this false belief that it could serve only, or it's accessible only to a more privileged person. We can understand why people are thinking this, because, you know, you think of the Maslow pyramid, there's been needs that need to be filled before thinking about psychological well-being. Some people think this way, but actually, as we mentioned earlier, psychological well-being could be a really nice buffer against the effect of stress. And when we think about psychological well-being this way, then you can imagine really easily how actually psychological well-being could be really beneficial for a different group of the population. You mentioned lower socioeconomic status, who are facing really different challenges on a day-to-day basis. And I think this is where the science of well-being could contribute and try to improve their quality of life and help them cope with different challenges. And of course, you know, engaging in this kind of psychological work, you need the mental space to do this, and beyond financial resources. So this is why we should make them these strategies more accessible. But as I mentioned, some exercises are more simple to do. So what would be a good way of making these exercises more accessible to the different group of the population that could require less skills to do them upfront, or less resources compared to seeing a psychotherapist, for instance.
And one of the first steps then being spreading awareness that this is something that can be done. It's something that is important. It's something that can be beneficial. And there are steps that you can take no matter where you are at in life, so that people find these solutions and try them out and find something that works for them and that fits their need.
Yes, absolutely. You know, they're increasingly prescribing going in nature for health. Physicians are increasingly talking about this. And I'm really hoping that there will be something parallel to that with psychological well-being. So becoming systematically screened when you go and see your physician. This is for your physical health, but there is always a couple of questions about anxiety and depression. So when will be the day that we'll start talking about how are you doing, not only in terms of happiness, but in terms of life satisfaction, purpose in life, optimism, and then prescribe some exercises that you can do at home to try to foster and promote well-being.
Because I think also an important aspect of it is that, yes, it can increase our lifespan, it can improve our health, but none of us know how much time we have. And the important part is also to increase the quality of life in the now. What is making me happy and joyful now? How can I enjoy the experience I'm having right now? Because we never know how long that will last, no matter our health status. And I think that is, like, it's an important means in itself to be happy in a way. And that this is also why we should be looking more into it, because it improves our experience in the now.
Absolutely. A good outcome on its own, as we like to say. So a lot of different benefits on physical health. There is a totally parallel body of research looking at productivity at work, how well-being could be important for our professional life. But as you mentioned, as an outcome on its own, we're interested in improving and promoting psychological well-being for everyone.
So where's this research field going now? Is there anything that you're really excited about that's coming up in the future?
Yes, well, plenty of different things. As I mentioned, trying to understand the healthy aging, so moving beyond chronic diseases and promoting aging and health among the population. And we have a population that is aging. There is a shift. So how can we make that as smooth as possible in a way? There is a lot of interesting biomarkers that are coming up. The gut microbiome is one, how that relates to psychological well-being. Personally, I'm really interested in how psychological well-being relates to how people cope and regulate their emotions. So do we see different emotion regulation strategies or coping strategies depending on how people are on different dimensions of psychological well-being? I think it's an interesting way of thinking about how people do and how that could impact their mental and physical health as well.
Really amazing. It was so much fun talking to you. Thank you so much for the important work that you're doing. I am so grateful to be part of spreading this knowledge to more people so that more people can learn more, get curious, find ways to help themselves. So thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much for having me, Maria. It was a pleasure.
So, this is very exciting research for many reasons. We are understanding more and more about different aspects of health and human flourishing, and how breaking it down into components gives us the opportunity to study it in more detail and learn how these different components impact well-being. With this knowledge, we can then refine methods for improving health, longevity, and contentment with life. Purpose in life, personal growth and mastery, happiness, optimism, and life satisfaction are components that have shown a beneficial effect on physical health. Most of these components showed effects such as reduced risk of dying or developing certain cardiovascular diseases over time. The reasons for this could be explained through different pathways, the first being behavioral. People with higher levels of psychological well-being seem to maintain healthier habits over time, such as reduced smoking or alcohol consumption or increased healthy eating or exercise. People with high purpose in life seem more likely to follow medical recommendations, such as health screenings, which can promote better health over time. In addition, there are biological pathways, where data shows that higher life satisfaction can increase antioxidants and improve lipid levels, for example. It could also be beneficial through increased resilience and buffering or undoing the negative effects of stress. An important shift in how we think about psychological well-being is that we now know that it's more than just the absence of psychological distress. Research has shown that people with depression or anxiety can, despite having no change in those symptoms, still improve their overall psychological well-being through increasing different positive components. This means that it's beneficial to work on, for example, purpose in life, optimism, or personal mastery in parallel with treating depressive symptoms or anxiety. Even though there is much we can do on the individual level, it is equally important to work on implementing health promotion through the environment. This means, for example, increasing the access to knowledge on psychological well-being, for example, by teaching children in school or running public campaigns. Another way is to support access to therapy by increasing insurance coverage, or to design infrastructure to provide more nature experiences close to where people live. And finally, something important to remember. Psychological well-being is an important outcome on its own. We don't know how much time we have, and I believe spending it as much as we can, enjoying contentment, is spending it wisely. Thank you for joining this episode, and if you found the material interesting, have a look at the website, brainobservations.com, and don't forget to subscribe.